Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from bodhiarchive.org.
Imagine committing the absolute ultimate moral failure.
Just a complete betrayal.
Right, a betrayal of your deepest, most sacred vows. And it's a betrayal that, well, it spirals so completely out of your control that it actually results in the taking of a human life.
The weight of that guilt would just be, I mean, absolutely.
It would crush you. You would likely believe yourself to be completely irredeemable, you know, permanently stained and destined for the absolute lowest depths of suffering.
Naturally, yes. Anyone would.
But now imagine being told by the most awakened mind in the universe that the only way to truly purify that horrific karma isn't through endless agonizing penance.
Which is what we always expect, right? Penance.
Exactly. Instead, the path to purity requires realizing that the murderer, the victim, and even the self who committed the act, they never actually possessed any solid, independent existence in the first place.
It's a premise that completely shatters our conventional understanding of morality and of consequence.
It really does.
And it requires us to step very carefully, with immense reverence, into a profoundly challenging philosophical space. Welcome. It is a genuine privilege to sit with you today to share in this study of the Dharma.
Yes, truly.
Let us just take a measured breath together, leaving behind the rushing currents and mundane anxieties of the day to simply arrive.
I think we all need that.
We are holding up to the light a sacred treasure from the Tibetan Buddhist canon today. It's a text brought into the English language through the painstaking dedication of the 84,000 Project.
And the text is called The Noble Mahayayana Esotra, Purification of Karmic Obscurations.
To truly receive the transmission of this Esotra, we need to, well, locate ourselves within it. Imagine the heat and the dust of ancient India.
We are in the great city of Vaishali, resting in the cool, profound shade of Amrapali's Grove.
And Amrapali, for those who might not know, was a renowned courtesan of immense wealth.
Right.
But upon encountering the teachings, she experienced this profound awakening and offered her magnificent mango grove as a sanctuary for practice.
In this serene oasis, the Buddha Shakyamuni is dwelling, and he's surrounded by an assembly so vast, it honestly defies ordinary comprehension.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, there are 500 monks representing the absolute bedrock of monastic discipline, you know, the moral foundation of the path.
But alongside them are 32,000 great bodhisattvas.
Which is staggering.
It is. And we must understand what a bodhisattva is in this specific context. These are beings who have generated bodhicitta.
The radical vow.
Yes, the unwavering vow to attain complete enlightenment, not as an escape from the world for themselves, but solely for the benefit and liberation of all sentient beings.
Among them is the youthful Manjushri. He is the very embodiment of transcendent wisdom.
This is the gathering we are joining right now. Beings of supreme realization, seated under the mango trees, waiting for the Buddha to navigate a tension that lies at the very heart of spiritual practice.
And that tension is exactly why this teaching is so incredibly vital for your practice today. It addresses the agonizing friction between the strict, necessary rules of moral discipline.
What we call the Vinaya.
Right, the Vinaya versus the ultimate liberating yet incredibly disorienting metaphysical reality of emptiness or shunyata.
It can be so disorienting.
To make this tangible, think about your own deep moral regrets. It is like carrying a heavy, jagged stone in your pocket.
That's a powerful image.
Every step you take, you feel its weight. Every time you reach into your pocket, the sharp edges cut your hand. You just carry it everywhere.
And you believe this stone is the absolute truth of who you are. You believe you deserve the pain it causes.
Exactly. And most of our worldly and even spiritual practices, they focus on trying to file down the sharp edges of that stone, or maybe trying to stitch a stronger pocket so it doesn't tear through the fabric quite as easily.
Because we operate under the unquestioned assumption that the stone is absolutely real, that the pocket is real. And above all, that the I who carries the stone is this fixed, permanent entity that is forever stained by the past.
But this teaching demands something far, far more radical. It is not offering a coping mechanism for carrying the stone more comfortably.
No, not at all.
It demands that you pull the stone out, hold it under the blazing light of transcendent awareness, and examine whether the stone, the pocket, and the carrier actually exist in the way your suffering mind insists they do.
Which brings us to the core mission of our study today. We are going to explore how true purification of our darkest karma obscurations, the heavy residues of our actions, is achieved.
And it's not merely through correcting our behavior or wallowing in guilt, is it?
No. It is achieved through realizing the non-arising empty nature of all phenomena.
To understand this, we really have to look at the narrative that sets this entire teaching into motion.
It begins with the tragic fall of a monk named Stainless Light.
Yes, Stainless Light. He is a monk of impeccable standing. One morning, he enters the great city of Vaishali for his daily alms round.
He is simply walking the path of his daily monastic routine, completely relying on the generosity of the lay community.
Just going about his day.
Exactly. And as he moves quietly from house to house, his bowl in hand, he crosses a threshold without knowing whose residence it is. He accidentally arrives at a prostitute's home.
And that word accidentally is so important here. This lack of premeditation is vital to the karmic anatomy of everything that follows.
Completely vital. He has not sought out temptation. He is holding his vows perfectly.
But the moment he enters, he steps into this concentrated vortex of samsaric grasping.
Samsandra being, of course, this cycle of conditioned existence, driven entirely by ignorance and desire.
Right. So the prostitute sees him, and an overwhelming fatalistic lust just seizes her mind. She actually thinks, I will not let this monk go without sleeping with him. If I fail, I will die.
It perfectly encapsulates the terrifying intensity of worldly desire. It literally feels like a matter of life and death to the ego.
She shuts the door. The quiet street is gone, and Stainless Light is trapped. She explicitly threatens him. She demands he sleep with her or she will die.
And Stainless Light holds the line brilliantly at first, doesn't he?
He does. He calls her Auntie. Attempting to diffuse the sexual tension with respectful, familial language, he pleads with her, explaining his strict adherence to the precepts prescribed by the Buddha.
He states clearly that he would rather die than engage in sexual activity.
Yes. He is fully willing to sacrifice his physical life to protect his spiritual integrity.
But the snares of conditionality are deeply, deeply subtle. Recognizing that brute force and direct threats will not break his resolve, she pivots to deception.
Which is so much more dangerous.
It is. She feigns a retreat. She assures him she has no desire to impair the Buddha's precepts and humbly asks him to graciously accept her alms.
And Stainless Light, believing the crisis has passed, he lowers his defenses. He assumes he is back within the safe, predictable parameters of his alms round.
However, as she prepares the food inside, she employs a secret mantra and a magic drug, bewitching the offering.
When she pours this tainted food into his bowl and he consumes it, the trap snaps shut.
The instant the food enters his system, his perception is radically, forcibly altered. The drug and the spell induce this enormous, fantasizing longing.
This is a terrifying moment for anyone walking a spiritual path. It is the absolute betrayal of one's own biology and conditioning.
Because Stainless Light did not choose to generate lust.
No, not at all. It was induced in him chemically, magically, circumstantially. Yet the moment that lustful intention arises, the battle is effectively lost.
She sees the shift in his eyes, takes him by the hand, and leads him to the bed. The highest vow of a monk, the bedrock of his renunciation, is completely shattered.
But what we really need to examine is the psychological aftermath. The spell eventually wears off. The biological drive subsides. What happens next?
What follows is the devastating crystalline clarity of remorse. Stainless Light gathers up his bowls, completely shattered, and retreats to the main temple.
His internal monologue is just a portrait of absolute despair. He thinks, oh, woe is me. I have just violated all that is contained in the Buddha's great teaching of moral conduct.
He does not view this as a singular failing, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
He views it as a totalizing corruption of his entire being.
He concludes he's no longer worthy of the faithful's offerings and that he is doomed to fall into the great hell realms.
His identity is completely inverted.
Exactly. At dawn, he was a pure vessel of the Dharma. By noon, he perceives himself as a corrupted, irredeemable sinner. The jagged stone is in his pocket, and it is tearing him to shreds.
He is fully bought into the dream of karma. He believes in the absolute, concrete reality of his own destruction.
But his companions, exhibiting true spiritual friendship, they do not cast him out. They point him toward the great Bodhisattva youthful Manijudi.
They tell Stainless Light that Manjushu possesses a specific, profound realization. They say he has attained patient forbearance in seeing all phenomena as non-arising.
We cannot gloss over this phrase. It is the structural foundation of the entire SOOTRA. What exactly does this highly technical phrase mean for a practitioner?
Right, let's unpack it slowly. All phenomena refers to every single thing you can perceive, conceive, or experience.
Physical objects, Thoughts, emotional states.
Memories, identities, virtues, and sins. Everything. Non-arising means that none of these phenomena have ever come into existence as solid, independent, self-contained entities.
They appear to us, certainly.
They do. They function within the complex matrix of cause and effect. But they do not possess intrinsic, unchangeable reality. They are like a reflection in a mirror or a rainbow.
You can see the rainbow, but if you fly toward it, there is no solid arch of color to actually touch.
Precisely. Finally, patient forbearance is the profound, unshakable mental fortitude required to accept this truth.
Because when you truly realize that nothing exists in the rigid way you thought it did, including your own ego, it can initially induce terror.
It absolutely can. To have patient forbearance is to stand in the blazing, unmitigated light of emptiness without blinking, without running back to the comfort of our solid illusions.
Because Manjushu sees that the monk's transgression never truly arose as a solid, permanent entity, he has the capacity to expunge the illusion of its karmic weight.
So Manjushu takes this crushed, silent monk directly to the Buddha. Stainless Light is too consumed by shame to even look up.
Manjushu has to relate the events on his behalf, and now we witness the Buddha's intervention.
And it's fascinating because the Buddha does not pull out the monastic rulebook. He does not act as a judge pronouncing a sentence.
No, he acts as a supreme physician of the mind. He employs this relentless Socratic method to dismantle the monk's constructed reality of guilt.
The dialogue is a masterpiece of deconstructive inquiry. The Buddha first establishes the facts. Yes, the act occurred. Then he isolates the mechanism of karma intention.
He asks, did you have a prior intention to engage in lustful conduct? Stainless Light answers no.
The Buddha probes further. If lustful thoughts did not arise, how did you come to engage in lustful conduct?
The monk explains that his lustful mind arose later, heavily conditioned by the bewitched food.
The Buddha asks, did you engage in your passionate act with that mind? Stainless Light says no.
The Buddha is meticulously demonstrating that the mind is not a single stained monolith. It is fluid. It is subject to fleeting conditions.
He reminds the monk, when their minds are afflicted, sentient beings become controlled by their afflictions. When their minds are purified, they become pure.
And then the Buddha delivers a reality-shattering analogy. He pivots completely away from the waking world and asks Stainless Light to examine his dreams.
He asks, in your sleep, when dreaming, did you ever engage in passionate acts?
The monk admits he has. The Buddha confirms, do you not know that it is your mind that engaged in passionate conduct?
Yes. Then comes the strike that breaks the illusion.
The Buddha asks, do you think that there is a difference such that your dreaming mind and your waking mind are separate and distinct?
Stainless Light realizes the truth and answers, I do not see the slightest distinction between the dreaming mind and the waking mind.
The ontological implications here are just staggering. The Buddha is forcing the practitioner to acknowledge that the terror, the pleasure, the physical sensations, and the seemingly solid reality experienced in a dream are entirely fabricated by the mind.
Yet, while you are inside the dream, they feel absolutely unquestionably real.
But when you wake up, you do not go to the authorities to confess a crime you committed in a dream, because upon waking, you recognize the dream lacked inherent reality.
The Buddha is applying that exact same status to the waking world. Have I not taught that all phenomena are like dreams? He asks.
If the waking mind and the dreaming mind are both ultimately non-existent as solid entities, how can a non-existent thing arise, cease, or travel to a literal hell realm?
The heavy, jagged stone vanishes because Stainless Light realizes he has no pocket, there is no stone, and the he who is carrying it is merely a momentary configuration of causes and conditions, deep and empty like space.
But, okay, I have to stop here. I need to push back hard on behalf of anyone listening who is trying to live an ethical life.
Please do. It's a necessary friction.
If the waking mind and the dreaming mind are equally devoid of reality, doesn't this give us a free pass? It reminds me of the argument against using a VR headset as a moral framework. If I put on a VR headset, I can steal cars, cause mayhem, and hurt simulated people. And when I take the headset off, when I wake up, there are no consequences.
Right.
Does this teaching not invite a dangerous, destructive nihilism where I can cause immense harm in the real world and simply wave my hand saying, oh, it's all a dream, it doesn't matter?
That is the most crucial, dangerous edge of this entire philosophy.
Right.
It is the razor upon which the Madhyamaka middle age philosophy taught by the great master Nagarjuna must balance.
So how does it avoid falling into nihilism?
Because falling in the trap of nihilism is a profound misunderstanding of emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
Emptiness does not mean nothingness. Emptiness means dependent origination, or in Sanskrit, pratitasa mutpada.
Dependent origination, okay.
Okay. Because things lack a solid, independent core, they are fluid. And because they are fluid, they exist in a constant state of cause and effect.
Right.
To say phenomena are like a dream or like a mirage is not to say they do not function. If you are dying of thirst in a desert, a mirage of water will not quench your thirst. But the illusion still functions perfectly to deceive your eye and draw you off the path.
Wow, yes.
Within the dream of samsara, if you burn your hand, the pain is agonizingly real to the dreaming mind. Karma operates flawlessly within the illusion. If you perform harmful actions, you will absolutely experience the agonizing consequences within the dream.
I see. So it isn't that the suffering doesn't exist, it's that the suffering is real specifically to the mind that is trapped in the illusion. The illusion still has teeth.
Precisely. The illusion bites, and it bites hard. The Buddha is not telling stainless light that actions have no consequences in the relative world. He's pointing out the ultimate nature of reality.
Because all phenomena lack a solid, independent core, they cannot permanently, inherently taint the luminous, pristine nature of the mind itself.
The mind, in its ultimate nature, is like space. You can detonate a bomb in space, or fill it with toxic smoke, or fill it with beautiful music. The space itself is never burned, never poisoned, and never improved.
It simply accommodates the passing phenomena.
Exactly. The Buddha tells him, while all phenomena are luminous in this way, childish, ordinary beings construct unreal phenomena, construct erroneous qualities, and thus they will go to hell.
It is the grasping at the illusion as solid reality that propels beings into suffering.
Yes. A truly non-arising phenomena cannot be dragged to hell. But a mind that firmly believes it is a solid, inherently existing sinner will manifest the experience of hell with terrifying, flawless precision.
That distinction changes everything. The purity isn't achieved by scrubbing the stain out of the fabric. The purity is realized by recognizing that the fabric itself is made of unobstructed light, and the stain is merely a shadow passing over it.
That's a beautiful way to phrase it. And the text follows this with a litany of breathtaking statements.
The Buddha says, as all phenomena lack a core, they are like space. As all phenomena are devoid of reality, they are not real entities. As all phenomena are free of hatred by nature, there is no hatred.
When stainless light truly hears and integrates this, the text says he felt immense joy and relief. The realization is so potent that 32,000 beings in the assembly spontaneously generate the mind of enlightenment.
It is a moment of profound cosmic celebration.
Yet it serves as the transition into the next, arguably even more challenging phase of the SO-Otra.
Because the implications of this emptiness cannot stop at merely purifying our bad deeds.
Right. If bad deeds are empty, we must logically confront the other side of the coin.
After the Buddha predicts stainless light's future attainment of awakening, his attendant, the Venerable Ananda, asks a critical question. He asks, how does one become obscured, and how non-obscured?
The Buddha hesitates here. He warns that explaining this fully will confuse the world.
But Manushir presses him, insisting that future bodhisattvas need to hear this to drop their worldly attachments.
Which leads us to a paradox that completely flips conventional spiritual logic on its head.
Okay, if my worst sins are empty, does that mean my greatest virtues are empty too?
The Buddha delivers a list of obscurations that is truly shocking. He begins as we would expect. Attachment is an obscuration. Hatred is an obscuration. Ignorance is an obscuration.
These are the classic three poisons.
But he does not stop there.
Yeah.
He continues. Generosity is an obscuration. Moral conduct is an obscuration. Patience is an obscuration. Diligence is an obscuration. Meditation is an obscuration. Transcendent awareness is an obscuration.
He even says that perceiving the Buddha and perceiving emptiness itself are obscurations.
Manjushir immediately asks the question we are all thinking. How can generosity be an obscuration? How are the PAHRAMITAS, the very perfections we are instructed to practice for lifetimes, obscurations?
The Buddha's explanation is a surgical dissection of spiritual materialism and spiritual pride.
The obscuration does not lie in the action of giving itself or the action of meditating itself. The obscuration lies entirely in the grasping, the identity-making, that ordinary childish minds layer on top of the virtue.
When phenomena are empty, taking a rigid, egoic stance on a virtuous identity creates a dualistic trap just as surely as a sinful identity does.
Let's deeply analyze how these virtues become traps using the specific examples the Buddha provides.
Think about how insidious this is. The Buddha says, when childish ordinary beings practice generosity, they do it with disrespect toward miserly sentient beings.
You volunteer your time, you give away your wealth, and almost instantly a subtle thought arises.
Look at me, I am generous. I am not like my neighbor who hoards his money.
That disdain, that judgment, the Buddha says, leads to anger and resentfulness, which plunges the practitioner straight into the lower realms.
The generosity, the very act meant to free them, became the vehicle for their spiritual downfall because it inflated the ego.
Exactly. And he walks methodically down the list of perfections. Moral conduct, you keep your vows perfectly. But you look at those who struggle, who break their vows, and you disparage them.
You treat them contemptuously. That contempt causes disrespect to spread, creating immense negative karma.
Or consider patience. You endure hardship, insult, or injury without fighting back. But internally, you are declaring, I have immense patience, while these others are petty and bear harmful thoughts.
You become intoxicated with the arrogance of your own forbearance. You are fundamentally disconnected from the humanity of the other person, looking down from a pedestal of perceived spiritual superiority.
The section on meditation is particularly piercing for modern practitioners.
Oh, yes. He says, when they spend their time in the equilibrium of meditation, they give rise to attachment to the joyful bliss of meditation and think, we spend our time in equipoise. Those other monks spend their time in mental distraction. How will they ever become Buddhas?
This is the trap of the spiritual elite. You achieve calm states on the cushion, and you look at the chaotic, struggling world with a mixture of pity and disdain.
The Buddha says people who think like this will cling tightly to samsara for eons. The very practice designed to liberate them has become the strongest, heaviest chain binding them to the illusion of a superior self.
Even entering the Mahayana path itself can become a trap.
Wait, really?
Yes. If one thinks we are foremost in this world, we are the best, our vehicle is supreme, and looks down on those practicing foundational vehicles, that arrogance guarantees a rebirth in the lower realms.
The core issue here is duality. Whenever you construct an I that is essentially good, you must simultaneously necessarily construct a they that is bad or lesser or unawake.
That separation is the root of ignorance. It obscures the truth of dependent origination and emptiness.
But this forces me to ask a really difficult question. It's a beautiful thought to transcend all this, but how is that actually possible for a human mind?
It is the ultimate challenge of practice.
If the very act of practicing generosity or patience risks inflating my ego and obscuring my mind, how can we possibly practice them? If I see someone suffering, my instinct is to feel pity, which inherently separates me from them as the helper and them as the helpless.
Right.
How do we bypass our biological and social wiring to practice virtue without falling into the trap of being good?
The Buddha answers this by offering a profound shift in perspective, utilizing the analogy of a physician. Manjushri asks if bodhisattvas shouldn't be praised for their altruism.
And what does the Buddha say?
The Buddha asks if a bodhisattva regards all sentient beings affectionately.
Yes.
Would they forsake even a few beings? No. Why? Because true bodhisattvas view all beings the way a master physician views patients.
A true physician does not judge a patient for being sick. They do not feel morally superior because they do not currently have a fever.
Exactly. They attend to a powerful king and a destitute beggar with absolute unwavering equanimity, driven solely by the desire to alleviate illness.
That makes sense. The physician doesn't stand over the bed saying, I am an amazing healthy doctor and you are a pathetic diseased patient.
The physician simply recognizes the presence of suffering and applies the necessary medicine.
There is no egoic identity built on top of the act of healing.
Precisely. When a bodhisattva deeply realizes emptiness, they realize there is no fundamentally separate self that is saving an inherently existing other.
The generosity flows naturally, like water flowing downhill to fill an empty space.
The patience is effortless because there is no solid, brittle ego present to be offended. The obscuration only occurs when the childish mind steps in, claims the action, and says, look at me being a bodhisattva.
True bodhicitta operates without this grasping. It is not enough to simply play the role of a highly spiritual person. One must realize the empty nature of the entire performance.
This realization of emptiness leads us directly into the most radical and frankly the most dangerous sounding section of the entire esotra.
We move from the paradox of virtuous obscurations to the actual integration of afflictions.
Taken out of the context of emptiness, the Buddha's statements here sound completely antithetical to basic Buddhist morality.
He says that bodhisattvas attain purification by seeing all phenomena as objects of desire, hatred, or delusion.
He says they attain purification by openly delighting in the pleasures of the five senses without renouncing them.
He even states that a bodhisattva attains purification by seeing the realms of samsara as the sphere of nirvayeshana. How do we comprehend this without descending into pure hedonism?
We can only comprehend it through the rigorous, absolute logic of the Madhyamaka view. We must remember what we established earlier. All phenomena are empty. They arise from what the text calls the ground of space.
The Buddha asks Manjushri, does a phenomenon engage in afflicted acts with respect to another phenomenon?
Manjushri answers no. Because things are utterly empty, they cannot truly interact as solid, independent entities. A mirage of water cannot extinguish a mirage of fire.
Therefore, the afflictions themselves, the desire, the hatred, the ignorance, do not have inherent existence.
They are not demonic entities possessing the mind. They are manifestations of energy, empty of substance.
So if they are completely empty of substance, then fighting them, suppressing them, or running away from them in terror is just as delusional as indulging in them. In both cases, you are treating them as real, solid threats.
Yes. The highest Mahayana view suggests that the raw, underlying energy of the afflictions, when entirely stripped of the grasping ego, is identical to the energy of awakened wisdom.
Samsara is nirvayeshana, when the mind completely ceases to construct boundaries and labels.
The bodhisattva who truly sees phenomena as arising from the ground of space does not need to flee the five senses, because the senses are no longer perceived as traps to be feared.
They are recognized as the miraculous empty play of the universe.
The bodhisattva does not ultimately distinguish between malice and patience, because both are equally ungraspable, like clouds dissolving in a vast sky.
To illustrate this radical grace, the Buddha tells a story from a past eon, and I must warn you, this narrative is intense.
It pushes the boundaries of redemption to their absolute breaking limit.
It is the tragedy of the monk Viradatta. The Buddha sets the scene. Viradatta is a handsome, highly learned monk who strictly, perfectly practices the moral code.
He goes to the city for alms and visits a merchant's home. The merchant's daughter sees him, and just like the situation with Stainless Light, she is struck with an obsessive, fatalistic lust.
She thinks, if I do not gain the monk Viradatta as my husband, I will die. She falls deathly ill with lovesickness, refusing all food.
The immense, suffocating weight of samsara is laid bare here. The girl's mother, terrified for her daughter's life, discovers the root of the illness.
She constructs a desperate plan. She approaches Viradatta and begs him to come to the house regularly to teach her daughter the Dharma, falsely claiming that being prevented from hearing the teachings is what made the girl sick.
Viradatta, motivated by genuine compassion and perhaps a naive, unexamined adherence to his duty as a teacher, agrees.
He says, "Do not prevent this girl from listening to the Dharma. I shall impart instruction to this girl." He steps willingly, compassionately, right into the web.
The proximity does its insidious work. The mother encourages the girl to adorn herself with jewels and fragrant sandalwood to seduce him.
The constant daily contact, the sensory allure, begins to erode Viradatta's iron discipline.
The text is unflinching. Preoccupied by desire and being in her company, he became fettered by desire. He came together with the girl and had full sexual intercourse with her.
The primary vow is broken. But the tragedy doesn't stop there. The entanglement escalates into a horrifying nightmare.
A suitor who had previously asked for the girl's hand hears about the affair. Fueled by intense jealousy, the suitor explicitly threatens to kill Viradatta.
And this is where we witness a mind entirely unmoored from its ethical foundation and clouded by blinding fear and attachment plunge into the abyss.
When Viradatta hears of the threat to his life, his basic preservation instinct overrides all his years of training. He procures poison.
He gives it to the girl and says, if you love me, kill your suitor with this poison.
She mixes it into food, sends it via a maid, and the suitor eats it and dies.
We must pause to absorb the sheer gravity of this. This is not a story of a monk who accidentally had a lustful thought during meditation.
This is a catastrophic, total moral collapse.
He has broken the most fundamental, unbreachable vows. He has committed sexual misconduct, and he has orchestrated the premeditated taking of a human life.
In the monastic code, these are defeat offenses. You are expelled for life. Your robes are stripped. It is a spiritual death sentence.
To return to our earlier analogy, this isn't just dropping the jagged stone on your toe. This is a physician deliberately, knowingly injecting a patient with poison.
How can a mind that has generated the intention to murder and succeeded ever possibly be purified?
From the conventional worldly standpoint, it seems completely impossible, and Viradatta himself believes it is impossible.
As soon as he learns the man is dead, he collapses into absolute crushing despair.
He thinks, I have committed a horrific deed. I have indulged in pleasure, and moreover, I have caused a man to die. What kind of creature am I? I will fall into the hell realms.
He wanders from temple to temple, literally falling to the ground like a felled tree, weeping in unendurable agony.
He finally arrives at the snow temple, utterly broken, crying out to the universe, I have become a sentient being of the hell realms.
In the depths of this hell, he is met by a magnificent figure, the Bodhisattva, liberator from fear.
The Buddha later reveals to the assembly that this figure is actually the great Bodhisattva Maitreya, the future Buddha.
Maitreya approaches the weeping, shattered Viradatta and says, Monk, do not be afraid. I shall bring an end to your fear.
Maitreya leads him into a thick forest, hovers in the air, and enters a profound state of meditative absorption.
Suddenly, golden forms of Buddhas emerge from Maitreya's body, filling the entire forest with brilliant light. And these emanated Buddhas begin to teach.
They speak verses that are some of the most profound, beautiful expressions of emptiness in all of Buddhist literature.
We must look very closely at these verses. They are the precise medicine that cures the supposedly incurable disease of Viradatta's guilt.
The golden Buddha's chant. All these phenomena are like reflections. Just as the moon appears in water, yet it's not there. Immature minds have become dim and afraid, thus creating toxic thoughts of lust and hate.
Notice carefully what they're doing. They are not minimizing the murder. They are not offering cheap grace, saying, don't worry, it wasn't a big deal.
They are attacking the fundamental underlying root of the suffering, the belief in the solid reality of the phenomena.
A moon reflected in a still lake looks exactly like the actual moon. You can see its craters, it casts a glow. But if you reach out to grasp it, your hand simply passes through empty water.
The lust, the hatred, and the physical act of killing are exactly like that reflection.
The verses continue, meticulously dissecting the specific elements of the crime. When examined from within, lust cannot be found, nor has anyone ever discovered hate. Immature ones believe that they are attached, yet there is no one who has ever been so.
And then, addressing the murder directly, which is the hardest part to swallow. Wielding weapons and striving to kill, when in fact the weapon and killer do not exist. These phenomena resemble grass straws and walls. Mind can be found neither inside nor outside. Lust is no living creature nor sentient person. Hate is neither an individual nor a thing.
This is the ultimate unflinching deconstruction of samsara. To commit a murder, from the ego's limited perspective, there must be a solid permanent I who hates, a solid weapon that strikes, and a solid victim who dies.
But when examined with supreme exalted wisdom, the eye is just a fleeting aggregate of causes and conditions.
The hatred is a temporary energetic weather pattern. The weapon is entirely empty of inherent existence. Even the victim, in their ultimate nature, is empty.
The great tragedy of samsatra is that we suffer immensely over interactions between ghosts.
Maitreya is showing Viradatta that his agonizing guilt is based on a hallucination. Delusion, lust, and hatred do not exist. These illusions will never be real. All phenomena, like illusions or dreams, with no apparent origin, none exist.
There is one more stanza that strikes right to the absolute heart of the matter. Space is boundless, limitless, endless, inexhaustible, and unproduced. So too are all phenomena. They are like rain in the sky, pristine and crystal clear.
Viradatta, the murderer, the fallen, disgraced monk, hears these words. He sees the magnificent array of Buddhas.
And because his immense suffering had utterly shattered his egoic defenses, he had nothing left to defend, no pride left to uphold. His mind is wide open.
He fully recognizes the nature of this teaching. The text says he attained patient forbearance in seeing all phenomena as non-arising.
He is completely freed from his fetters. He achieves realization not by doing a million prostrations to pay off a karmic debt, but by waking up entirely from the dream of the debtor and the creditor.
And the Buddha concludes this story with a revelation that seals the ultimate promise of the Mahayasana path. He tells Manjushri that the monk Viradatta did not merely find a measure of peace. He attained manifest complete enlightenment.
He became the Tathagata jewel moon.
A Tathagata is one who has thus gone, or thus come, into the reality of emptiness. A fully awakened Buddha, presiding over a world system called eternal light.
The Buddha explicitly states the lesson for the assembly. Consider how someone attained patient forbearance despite having partaken of all he desired and having violently interrupted another's life.
How could that be? It was because he understood that everything in the three realms is untrue, and that all sentient beings are like optical illusions. When one abides in the illusion-like mind, there is no obscuration with respect to any phenomenon.
That is the astonishing, breathtaking climax of the teaching. The grace of the Dharma is absolute. It reaches down into the deepest, darkest hell realms of our own making and dissolves them not with force, not with punishment, but with the pure light of truth.
As we move toward the conclusion of this shared study, the Buddha reveals the names of this teaching to his attendant Ananda.
He says, "Retain this Dharma discourse with the name Purification of Karmic Obscurations. Also retain it with the name Entering the Unobscured Exalted Wisdom."
But he also calls it something else earlier in the discourse, a title that beautifully encapsulates everything we've discussed. He says to Ananda, "Comprehend this Dharma discourse," because Ananda is the Dharma mirror of all phenomena.
The metaphor of the Dharma mirror is the perfect, elegant summary of this entire SOOTRA. Think about the physical nature of a mirror.
A mirror reflects whatever is placed before it with perfect clarity and absolute impartiality.
It will reflect a pile of rotting garbage or a flawless diamond with equal precision. But the mirror itself is never permanently tainted by the garbage, nor is it structurally improved by the diamond.
When the objects are removed, the mirror remains exactly as it was, empty, luminous, and clear.
This SOOTRA acts as that mirror for the mind. It shows us that our greatest virtues and our darkest vices, our moments of profound generosity and our moments of catastrophic failure, are merely reflections passing across the unelaborated, empty nature of our true being.
The Buddha says this teaching burns away afflictions like a roaring fire burns dry grass and outshines spiritual darkness like the rising sun.
The liberating power of this realization is so vast that the text tells us the evil Mara, the embodiment of spiritual obstacles, and the lore of illusion approaches the Buddha in absolute terror.
Mara begs the Buddha not to expound this teaching, promising to do anything to prevent it from being practiced in our realm, which the text refers to as Jambudvipa, the human continent.
Mara knows that if beings realize they are merely dreaming, his power over them instantly vanishes.
But immediately, Indra, the chief of gods, appears. He prostrates and vows to protect this teaching.
He promises that after the Buddha passes into Nirvayajna, he will command the four great kings and the protective nature spirits to guard and shield those who hold and master this discourse.
Because of that vow, the teaching is secured for us right here, today, and we must bring this profound, sweeping philosophy back to your immediate daily practice.
We began by speaking of the heavy, jagged stone in your pocket, the guilt, the agonizing regret, the self-condemnation you may carry for past actions.
This SOOTRA teaches us that holding onto that guilt is just another subtle, insidious form of grasping. It is an egoic insistence on the solid reality of an illusion.
To obsessively condemn yourself is as much an obscuration as to arrogantly praise yourself. Both are deeply rooted in the lie of a permanent, unchanging I.
True freedom is not found in becoming a perfectly good person who never makes a mistake, because that person does not exist.
True freedom is found in recognizing the clear light of the unelaborated mind, resting in the patient forbearance that sees all things as non-arising.
We have journeyed deeply together today, through the devastating fall and ultimate liberation of stainless light, through the disorienting paradox of virtuous obscurations, and through the radical, terrifying redemption of Virdhata.
We have looked into the Dharma mirror as we prepare to part ways from this sacred grove of Vaisholi, returning to the currents of our lives. I want to leave you with a final contemplation to carry with you.
A vital question for practice.
If the most painful regrets that haunt your nights and the most luminous virtues you proudly display to the world are equally empty, if they are both truly just reflections in the water or clouds passing through the vast expanse of the sky, then who is the you that remains when the sky finally clears?
Authentic Tibetan teachings and transcripts from bodyarchive.org.